Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another edition of Rural Route, the program that we gather every day at this time. Well, we do it Monday through Friday anyway. And what we do when we gather is continue to address the issues between rural and urban America, more importantly, food producers with food consumers. On this Red Shirt Friday, by the way, next week I'll be in Colorado. The co-ops are going to gather in Loveland. I think I'm going to crash that party on Thursday, Friday. You hear that, Robert Farnham? Yeah, there's a delivery coming Thursday. Made in America. The fabric of America. That's exactly what we're going to talk about today because I just found online, social media, I found Gretchen Filia from the great state of Georgia. And I was out looking for a Georgia peach. Everybody's got to have a Georgia peach once in a while. It turns out I found one. Gretchen, I got my Georgia peaches all tongue-tied. Gretchen Filia. Filia. You told me three times. Gretchen, I'm just a slow learner, but once it sinks in this German skull, I get it. Coming to us from Georgia. And I saw a post that Gretchen had put up talking about USA loving manufacturing, talking about USA made. I wear my Schaefer vest and coats and Western wear because even the buttons are made in the USA. On a regular basis, I am talking about if we truly want to free ourselves from the rest of the world and the tyranny that we talk about on a regular basis, the number one place we do that is when we spend our consuming dollars. Gretchen, welcome to the program. Thanks for taking the time to join me.
Well, thank you. No, I appreciate it. And yeah, I like your vest. Very nice.
Were you familiar with Schaefer before I told you I was wearing a Schaefer?
I actually have to admit, surprisingly, I do not know that particular brand. So I learned something new, but I like that. I like to learn something new every day.
So do I. Well, we may stumble onto a lot of things that we have in common. You are founder of USA Loves Manufacturing. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so basically, it was a very, very organic thing that I started about 4 years ago. I just came up with the idea over the weekend. I was working in manufacturing. I worked for a company that was doing industrial repair and equipment. And so I was visiting a lot of manufacturers. Once we went from agrarian to industrial, that's how America was built, our true America. So I really felt a deep sense of connection with it and wanted to celebrate the people that were in manufacturing and celebrate manufacturing and technology. So I started the organization and it kind of grew because of social media.
So while I led us down this path of thinking about clothing, what I just heard you say was that your love for manufacturing extends beyond clothing, but to all things.
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, it basically, is everything that makes up America. You know, we automotive and component level, everything that we see all around our homes. It really does start with manufacturing. So it's so important that we, you know, continue to help manufacturing thrive in this country.
So I love everything about the idea here, Gretchen. I try to be astute in history so that I understand how manufacturing and those everyday blue collar jobs are what made America. It truly was the fabric of America.
Absolutely.
It's not today. How do we get back to that?
Yeah. And, you know, and that's the $1 million question. I certainly want America to get back to that because, as you know, it really, I believe it's the future of our country and the future's success. And it's not just about, I'm not, you know, my mind is not, you know, so narrow to think it only has to be everything is made here in America and there's nothing else. It's all black and white. No, that's obviously never going to work. But what you have to do first is you do have to, you know, start from the very beginning and then expand outward. And then you look at it in a responsible manner. It's about, you know, companies and, you know, whether it's technology, manufacturing, whatever. What are the companies that are responsible? They think about sustainability, ethics, et cetera. So it may be that, you know, we look to our partners. I say we look to our neighbors, like Mexico, Canada, the UK, whomever. There are many countries throughout the world that are responsible stewards of this earth. And that's really what it's all about. But it does start with America. And we have to bring back more and more manufacturing. So again, we can be stewards for all of Earth. And I see that that's the vision that I have and what I see and why it's so important.
And what I would really be interested in is how you thread that message of being an environmental stewards and yet being in a growing manufacturing nation once again, because I think incorrectly, too many people have got this false notion that if you're involved in manufacturing, you're really not an environmental steward. No, manufacturing is contributing to environmental stewardship, and you can lay out here's how it happens.
Absolutely. You know, if you think about it, we obviously the world is not flat. It's a round world. Whatever happens somewhere else in this world, it comes around to us and vice versa. So that's why it is very important that we look at environmental pieces. You know, obviously when our country and everyone else started in manufacturing way back when, there were things we didn't know. There was also, you know, people involved in the process that maybe they did know that there were issues, but they with, you know, chemicals, et cetera, they were using, but maybe they didn't care. We're not necessarily in that frame of mind anymore. I do believe that more and more people are looking at the health of our earth. So I'm hoping that if we can get this going again, it again will be done in a more responsible way. It's not just about money. We gave away so much of our manufacturing to other countries. And I hope now that we're seeing the impact that's making, that's what's important. It is not just about America. It's about our world. And if we don't, I'm afraid we're all going to suffer for it.
Gretchen, I happen to believe, let's just use one example, because then we can talk about a fabric that has been as old as this country, leather. Happens to be my favorite topic. When it comes to manufacturing, we chased leather tanneries out of the United States because we came up with this notion that the chemicals that are used are dangerous to the environment. So what we do is that we put all the leather together, we put them on an airplane, we ship them to China, and then they process them, and then we ship them back. And I'm thinking, okay, there is some impact to the environment through transportation. I don't know how great that actually is. But what I'm beginning to believe is that we came up with these false notions about the chemical dangers of producing them here when we know we can manage any chemical we use in manufacturing simply to create a hurdle for our own independence as a manufacturing nation.
Right, exactly. You know, it's kind of interesting because that you bring up leather tanneries because I live in Buford, Georgia, which is a little bit north of Atlanta. And Buford pretty much was built on a family called the Bona Allen family that they started a tannery in this town. It was obviously a small town. If you go to the downtown area of Buford, Georgia, which is very quaint, everything from this beautiful mansion to the buildings were based on this tannery. And, you know, again, when we were going from, you know, the agrarian community to the Industrial Revolution, you know, we didn't need the horse and buggy any longer, et cetera. They were even, you know, doing the old style, you know, whips, whatever. And then the tannery where they eventually had shoe factories, et cetera. So I see that every day that I'm here in my small town. And I absolutely love that history. And, you know, sometimes I did think about, you know, what are those chemicals that were used? You know, is that in our water supply? But you're absolutely right. There are ways that we can manage that at this point. And what is the carbon footprint to send back and forth these products that, you know, maybe they're assembled here, but they're made somewhere else? What is that carbon footprint? It's like, why are we not thinking in that way?
Gretchen Filia, one thing you certainly have accomplished in the first segment of this broadcast is you have people laughing at this cowboy from Nebraska is talking to somebody who's talking about quaint shops in Buford, Georgia. But it all happened thanks to a tannery. It's truly amazing how full circle things come. Gretchen, hang on. I know you can only be with us for the first half of the program, but we will continue this discussion about manufacturing. Coal is one of these products, and you can call coal manufacturing if you want. At the end of the day, what you want is the electricity to work. Coal makes it happen. Go check out the people behind the scenes that make it happen at lignite.com. We're back with more Gretchen Filia after this. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Trent Lewis alongside, joining me from Georgia, actually, Catherine Filia. And we are talking about the fabric of America. That's the name of her new TV program. But now I got to get up to speed on quaint. Quaint. I'm trying to figure out what that really means. I'm just having
Well, you guys have a lot of quaint things in Nebraska, too.
Have you been here?
No. I'm trying to think if I've probably driven through there at some point. I've seen a lot of states, but
you know, Gretchen, I get that all the time. I drove through there and there was nothing. Well, you know what I do? I turn that nothing into something that you can use in a tannery or on your plate.
Well, absolutely. And the air smells a little bit sweeter out there, I'm sure.
The air is perfect. All right. So you said you have a story with that jacket. What's your story?
Oh, right. Well, and again, it's interesting. We were talking about leather. This is suede, but you know, I lived in New York City right after college, and I was up there for a short while. But you know, I used to love to go down to Soho to shop, and you know, there were a lot of very small shops. And it's interesting because that was, I'm not going to say, I guess, exactly the year, but up until, you know, like mid-90s, there were a lot of clothing manufacturers still here in the USA. And now there's less than 3%, which is insane. I mean, when you really fathom that statement, it doesn't even make sense. But this was a company, everyone probably remembers or knows the company now, BB. It's changed a lot, but it was a very small clothing manufacturer, and they made fantastic clothes. And this is a jacket from way back when. And the reason why I wore it is to show I still wear this, and it is a fantastically made, very high quality piece of clothing. I don't shop a lot. It's not my thing, but, you know, I always look for quality items. And there are a lot of things I have from back, even that far back, that were made in the USA that I can still wear. You cannot say that about 9/10 of your clothing. And we all have way too much clothing, but fast fashion is destroying more than, you know, our environment. We think that clothes get donated, and this is very important, but we think that clothes get donated to Goodwill or whomever. Yes, it does help in some ways, but most of that clothing, and you think about how cheaply it's made and how it pills or the threads come off, et cetera, it does not get recycled to someone. It gets sent to other countries, and it is heaps upon heaps of pollution and trash in those other countries. So we all need to think about the amount of clothes that we wear and what we buy, because we don't need half of the clothes that we buy. And, you know, it's an education thing, I think, that we need to really start thinking about.
Well, there's two things that came to my mind. So there's both ends of the spectrum. You have most people in America who shop at the supercenter on the edge of town, who I don't name on this program, because it's the cheapest line of clothing that they can get. And that's all made in other countries, particularly Asian countries, because 87% of all textiles in the world are made in the Asian countries, China et al. The other end of the spectrum is, and this is, I'm not as well versed in this, so Gretchen, you're going to have to correct me when I misspeak, is that it seems like people who want to have a name brand clothing item, excluding you, because you've already bragged about something that was domestically produced, if it was in, it comes out of Paris, France, or it comes from Rome, Italy, or London, UK, it has greater prestige. And that leaves that big gap in the middle about somebody bragging about their Schaefer Western wear that has 100% American products.
Right. Well, you know, I was always a big fan of designer wear. You know, I would travel to Europe and I would love to go to Italy and, you know, be able to pick up when the euro was a little bit different. You know, I could have the nicer items and, you know, they weren't costing as much. And, you know, so, but I still have those items, the designer wallets or, you know, scarves, etc. I'm not trying to say I'm a Puritan. You know, I live a full life where I enjoy certain things, but what I am trying to say in a practical manner is if you look at the quality of American made items, there is a difference. And I think most of us can see that. If you ask the average American, would you spend a little bit more to have a made in the USA item? Most Americans will say yes. And, you know, and that's, there's a whole other conversation about that, that if we did just bring back a small percentage of manufacturing, the cost is going to go down pretty quickly. And when you hear about the cost of the difference in cost, they don't give you the full story. If you, just what you said earlier, you know, they're not looking at the soft costs. They're not looking at those, you know, intangibles or even the travel cost or supply chain issues. So when you really bring all of that in, then the difference between, say, clothing made somewhere else and clothing made here, there's not such a large gap. And I think most people would probably be fine with having less clothing that's going to last longer. And the aesthetic is there. So, you know, it's more, again, I believe in education and awareness also.
So I don't want to make myself sound like a stalker, but Gretchen, I've been in grocery stores and I've been in department stores where I do ask people that question. Would you pay more for something produced in the USA? Absolutely. I mean, it's just an ingrained answer. They couldn't think of answering it any other way. And then if you just sneak around and watch them buy what they buy what's cheapest.
Right.
I don't know how to fix that.
Well, I don't know if that's really a correct statement exactly because, and I don't mean it, you know, in that way, but.
If you come on here and correct me, you're going to get an invitation every day. I'm just telling you right now.
Yeah. Well, we might. Yeah. We'll have to have that conversation. I probably would be good at that, but, No, I'm joking. But, you know, when you look at not really the new generation, it seems like I have a 15 and 18 year old, both boys, and they're not, well, my younger one maybe is a little more designer oriented, but my older son is not as concerned about name brands. I mean, yes, of course they like certain shoes, et cetera, but I see a change in a younger generation where they're not as concerned with, oh, I've got to wear, you know, the things that we would say that, you know, we wanted to wear. I'm kind of like, I wear black mostly. And, you know, I can buy a black tank from Target. I can buy it from, you know, somewhere Dior, whomever. I can buy it from a wide range, but no one knows I wear black. So, you know, and if I like something, I'll buy 5 pieces of it, because I know I'm going to wear it for 5 years. But I see a change in the younger generation. And being that that's the case, it may be easier to persuade that generation that, you know, we can have American made items and the name brand is not as important, and, you know, kind of move that to a different way of thinking, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. And I think you're absolutely right. We have three daughters, 24, 20, and 17. And there is definitely a change. And I believe that you're spot on. That generation, they're not going to accept status quo. They're going to create some change in every way and shape and form in our life.
I believe that.
Gretchen, we're in the final minute. I'd love for you to leave us with something profound and make sure that people viewing know how to get a hold of you.
My responsibility, again, as a steward of the earth, and I know that sounds a little hokey, but it's very important because it's not just what happens here in America. I always feel like it's like the comment that they would say to mothers that if you're in a plane, put your oxygen mask on first before helping someone else. And I think the same way with us bringing manufacturing back or anything else. We have to take care of America first so we can help the rest of the world and be good citizens for everyone. And this is the first step, but it's an important step and we do have to do it.
That was as profound as anybody's closed this program out with. Gretchen, it's awesome. Fabric of America. We can't wait to see it coming out in December. Gretchen Filia joining us from Buford, Georgia, and it is time that we get back to the fabric of America, folks. It is about the fabric. One way of helping us get back to the fabric of America and a free and fed America is Protect the Harvest. You can go to the website every day. You can get the email newsletter. You can submit your comments. It's all about empowering our nation, our people, to take this country back at the grassroots level. It's very aptly named Protect the Harvest. What's more important than protecting our supply of food every step of the way? It actually just works lock and step with what Gretchen Filia is talking about here today. The next step is up to you. ProtectTheHarvest.com. Maintain a free and fed America. More after this. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Roll route to the program on this Red Shirt Friday, getting ready to make my trip to Colorado. I haven't been to Colorado for a while. Just saying. Before we carry on, and I've got Steve Lucy going to join us from Hancock County, Illinois, in a moment. It's an interesting story in the making, but we'll get to Steve. I just got a book this week, and I wanted to share it with you. I don't really know what I'm telling you. Here's what I'm telling you. I always take pictures. Every day I take pictures on my phone. I have posted a lot of those pictures on social media, and people have commented about them. So I've taken about, well, it's just a short 30 pages book with pictures that I've taken unfiltered, maybe some of them cropped, but no filters, no messing with, no photoshopping, nothing. And I've included a little statement that, either a Hank Vogler statement or something that I say or something like that, and put a caption to each picture I've taken. That is going to be a limited edition book sale coming up soon. Stay tuned. Details coming about that. Continuing here with this Red Shirt Friday. And this is about as interesting a story as I think I've ever stumbled upon. Because Steve Lucy, who we're going to call the Cattleman, is from Basco, Illinois. Everybody knows where metropolitan Basco, Illinois is in Hancock County. The funny thing is, he's within 3 years of my age, grew up 30 miles of where I grew up. And we got to meet on social media. Steve, I don't even understand how this is, although I spoke at a Hancock County cattleman's meeting once, and we never hooked up there. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Well, I'm just stumbling around here on a Red Shirt Friday. I see you didn't get the memo to wear a red shirt every Friday to say thank you to the men and women who've risked their lives to protect our freedom.
I didn't get that memo, but I will remember that. As you know, I've got a couple boys in the military, and my family history's had a long line of service. So it's very, very near and dear to me and our family. It's very important to us. And not a day goes by we don't think about that.
Which is exactly why I wanted you on Friday, particularly this Friday post Pearl Harbor, December 7th, 1941. You have two sons that are in the Army, I believe, and both of them went to West Point.
That is correct. My sons were very good wrestlers here in the little, they went to Warsaw, Illinois School District, and they got really good at wrestling. They were just, just hard-nosed, tough kids. And so that took them a long ways through high school, pretty well-known athletes in the area. But our area, it's rural and remote, right? I mean, most people don't know about our area, and especially even where I live. I live 15 miles from town even. But they got, they made their path, and they were smart kids, and they got looked at from Army wrestling, actually, at West Point. And then we had a good liaison from Quincy from West Point. So they each got an appointment to West Point, and they ended up wrestling for Army for 4 years. And now they've graduated with their commissions and moved on. And my oldest son's a captain right now. And my middle child, my son, is a first lieutenant now down at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. He's an engineer, and my oldest one's a armored division captain. So they've done really well. I'll throw in my daughter. West Point wanted her pretty bad too, but she was probably the smartest of all of us, but she chose a different path and went to school to become a teacher. And she did run cross country in college as well. So my kids are just hardworking kids. And I think that's the most important thing I want people to take out of this today. It's not necessarily that they were something special, overly brilliant. In fact, my sons were just normal, smart kids. When they got to West Point with all the, all the prep school kids that come in there and things of that nature, they had to work extra hard to get through that place, and which they did. So I'm very proud of their work ethic. And I think that's the most important thing I want people to realize today, that work ethic will take you a long way in life.
So there's several things here, Steve. First of all, with the All-American Beef Battalion, we have fed nearly 500,000 men and women in the United States military. A 1 pound ribeye, cheesy potatoes, dinner roll, dessert, and corn. I left out corn. Don't want to leave out corn. But by being on so many bases throughout the country and Fort Carson most often, you talk to these recruiters and they talk about those rural farm kids. And for the most part, I don't know how it's changed in the last 2 years since everything got wonky, but for the most part, 45% of the military comes from rural America. 45% comes from inner city America because they're looking for a way out and a place to go. And 10% is the balance of all of the above. But you talk to any recruiter and they will tell you that that rural farm kid is exactly who they want because of the reasons you just described.
Oh, it's 100% correct. And I guess I'm biased. So any of the viewers and fans can think what they want, but my sons were the same way. And again, they were wrestlers too. And wrestling, I don't know, that's a tough sport. That's a whole different level of work ethic and dedication. So an Army wrestler going out into the world of the military, their status comes up a little bit just because of that work ethic. And people know that. But I think there were, at the time, my oldest was out at West Point, which would have been 2014 he started. There were very, very few farm boys at West Point. And that has changed dramatically in those years now. I mean, there's a few, but not very many. And we need more of that, I think. We need more of that in our military. And hopefully that'll get turned around because, they're at a premium. And their commanders and people in the Army, they know that these kind of guys are at a premium. So they kind of move up pretty good, seems like.
Our youngest is a senior. She's 17, valedictorian of her class. In fact, her average score through school, not just high school, is 99.9. I think a PE teacher gave her less than a 100 at one point in time. And West Point, they do a good job of finding those kids, and they were very aggressively seeking her. My hat's off to you, and I wanted to talk to you, Steve, for a number of reasons, but when I found out you had two sons in the military, it's a tough time to be in the United States military, and if we didn't have those that are willing to be resilient and wade through the political nonsense that's happening to be a part of the military today, we would be extremely vulnerable. So I wanted to say thank you to your family for wading through that to continue to be there for us.
Well, I appreciate that. It is a difficult, you know, when I applaud your daughter, my daughter valedictorian too, and that kind of work, you know, what it takes to do that, no matter what high school they're in, to get that all the way through is something else. But I just appreciate that. I know my family appreciates that sentiment. It's a difficult path where they went because, and I remember still, you know, my son graduated in May, and in July 1st, he was gone to West Point, and we didn't see. I mean, I knew in my heart that was the last that we would have him living at home, but that was a fast track, you know, and I think it kind of hit us later on that this is what reality is. You know, a lot of parents take their kids, move into college, this and that. We didn't have that. We dropped him off. And I still remember his mother, you know, they kind of said you'd have 3 or 4 minutes to say goodbye in that auditorium. And the commander announced you got 60 seconds to say goodbye to your son. And that was that was a heartbreaking time. But, you know, we got through it. They're resilient. We're resilient people. You know, in the ag industry, you have to be. I mean, it's just part of life growing up. And all through, I'm a fifth generation farmer and rancher here on this farm. And I've seen my grandparents, my mom and dad go through tough times. And you just kind of buck up and get through it and go through life and do the best you can.
Well, that's why your sons are resilient, and we're not leaving your daughter out. We might talk about education. We will talk about education in the second leg of the journey here today. But my family came to Adams County, Illinois from Germany in 1832. I was sixth generation on our place, southeast of Quincy. And I didn't have the resolve that you do. There was no way I was going to raise kids in Illinois, despite the history and the heritage and how I appreciated everything that the former Luces had done to make it happen. It's just a tough place to continue to carry on that family tradition with what's been going on in hurdles and barriers coming out of Springfield and a little farther north, like Cook County.
It's very, very difficult. I don't know if you're aware, but I am a director of a group called Awake Illinois, and it's a child advocate group, parent advocate group. And I got started in that during the beginning of COVID when Illinois was putting down some pretty horrendous things to our children and our school children. And being in education for so many years, I was on the school board at Warsaw for 17 years. And my wife has been a lifelong teacher. She's an elementary teacher. So she saw that some of the things that they were doing was actually harming kids in their education. And I was passionate about that. I'm one of those guys that's kind of dug in here I'm about, probably 10, 15 miles as the crow flies from the Mississippi River. And we live in a beautiful place. People probably have seen some of my pictures on Twitter. It's wooded, it's pasture ground, and there's some farm ground. The farm ground isn't great. You know, 20 miles northeast up by Carthage is the prairie. We're not on that here, but I love where I live. And I think it's the best part of, you know, it's the best thing of Illinois is right where I live. The politics are horrendous, quite frankly, and we have some major things coming here. You've seen probably with the governor signing the Safety Act. We're going to have no cash bail and things of that nature. So I joke that it's going to be the Wild West, and I'm living out in the Wild West of Illinois, I think, right now.
That's why the six shooter is intact, but we'll take a break. Steve Lucy joining us from Hancock County, Illinois. We're not going to tell you how wonderful Basco is because we like the remoteness, and we're going to keep it. So how fitting is that? And we'll just keep that. All right, Steve Lucy, we will take a break, and we'll come back with much more on this Red Shirt Friday. We say thank you to the veterans, the first responders, and the best way to do that I know of is thewalloofhonor.org. Have you been to the website, thewalloofhonor.org? It's all about saying thank you. It's a monitor that we can put in. If people think about the wall, it's not a wall like the Vietnam wall. It's a wall that goes, it's a monitor that goes on your wall with a box in it that's continually updated with those individuals we need to pay honor to. thewalloofhonor.org. Into this Friday, a Red Shirt Friday. By the way, for those of you that did not follow, the Red Shirt Friday started at the end of World War II. The Ladies Auxiliary for the VFW suggested, hey, every Friday we should just wear a red shirt just to say thank you to those men and women returning from the beaches of France, Italy, the South Pacific. And how appropriate this week with December the 7th and those 2,400 that were impacted that day at Pearl Harbor, but the hundreds of thousands that were impacted going forward from that day on. Steve Lucy joining from Hancock County, Illinois, you know, just south and a little west of Carthage. You know the mayor in Carthage?
Yeah, Jim Nightingale. Sure do.
He's a tyrannical mayor. He's been a mayor since I was a little kid. He won't give up the power, and it's time, Jim, to give it up.
I heard a joke about that just the other day, and I just went on the Hancock County board.
Oh, really?
To the county board. Yeah. And so I'm just starting that journey in my life. We'll see how that goes. But Jim's a good guy. He used to buy hogs from us when we raised hogs. My family used to raise hogs for years and years. And my dad and I got out there in the early 90s when it got pretty rough. We were just the old school outside hogs. So there was a lot of work to that, and it wasn't making do.
Did you know Jim's wife, Connie?
I didn't know her. No.
She's my dad's first cousin.
Probably really as good as Jim, probably, I'd say.
No. She made Jim look good.
All right. There you go.
There you go. She was awesome. 17 years on the school board. You were ahead of the curve a bit there, Steve, because today I preach that everything's local. And if you want to deal with Pritzker and what's happening in Springfield or Chicago, you have to show up at the local school board or at the Hancock County Board of Commissioners, whatever the case may be. But you've been there, done that for quite some time. What got you involved the first time, motivated to say, I'm going to be a part of the school board? 17 years, that's a pretty good run.
Pretty good run. At the time, there was another farmer. He got off the board, so there was an appointment position open, and my name was brought up, and I considered it, and then I got appointed to the board. Well, then I ran the next election cycle and just stayed on. I had actually worked, before I got on the school board, I had worked to help pass a referendum to add on to our little school at Warsaw. And we got a lot of state money. It was like an 80% state pay, and then the taxpayers paid the rest. And we passed that something like 75, 80% margin. I was on the actual get out the vote committee, and I remember working with that. And we built a new gym down there at Warsaw and a new high school. And so that was a good deal. And then I just became involved, and my wife she was teaching at a neighboring district at the time, but actually that's not true. She actually got a job at Warsaw about 6 months before I got on the board, now that I remember right. So she was on the school board.
It's easier when you fact check yourself as we go along, Steve. So
right, right. And that's been 20 years ago. So it's hard to,
yeah, it's like it was yesterday,
all the details. But no, I just enjoyed it. And I was always one of those guys that, I guess you say I was a questioner, but that served me well, because, we went through four or five, six different administrators. And as a school board member locally, you are elected to control that school and that run that business. Yes, we hire a superintendent, but we've seen that sometimes they like to take a little bit of an overreaching control of a district. And that's why we have seven members on a board to have that voice. And if you just go on a school board and sit there like a lump and don't do anything, then you're not doing your diligence.
Or follow the script that the superintendent provided for you before the meeting, which is the biggest problem in all school boards.
100%. It is a big problem. And I think it's, I think it's a confidence thing for some people. I think it's an ignorance thing, to be quite blunt, for some people. And if you're on a school board, you need to, there's tools that you can do to find out information. And it's just a little bit of a, you know, it's a little bit of work, but find that stuff out. I'm a lifelong learner. I remember when my boys first got into wrestling, I didn't know anything about wrestling. I never wrestled in my life. Somebody told me, your boys might be tough kids. Let's do it. So I did it. And by the end of it, I was coaching youth wrestling and not even, I'd never done it, you know? So you can learn anything you want in life if you just if you're motivated to do it.
I've wrestled my entire life, Steve. The only thing is I've been wrestling pigs, not other people.
That's tough. We used to do, you know.
Whenever, when.
I, like I said, I did it the old-fashioned way, you know, back in the day. Yeah. And we would handle those 40, 50, 60-pound hogs and throw them down, and you'd have to hold them, and Dad would cut the boars. And, I mean, you talk about work. That's where you get that farm strength, Trent.
But that's great father-son time, because Dad and I did that for a long time.
It is. I tell you, my daughter's always been helpful on the farm as well. You know, just Thanksgiving, the boys couldn't come back, so I recruited my daughter. We worked about 50 head of feeder calves, running through the chute, and gave them a shot, and I banded the bulls, and she offered to help me that day before she went back to Mount Pleasant. She teaches high school in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, but, you know, she was probably one of my best hands I've ever had on the farm. So don't count out the ladies either.
Oh, the best cowboys aren't boys at all. That's not just a song. That's the way it is. We have three of those daughters, but you really screwed up, I got to tell you. Steve, you cannot have a mountain oyster feed if you continue to band these bulls. We castrated 50 bulls this weekend on Sunday. It was a perfect day to do it. We don't usually work on, well, we do too much on Sunday, but the weather was right. So we castrated 600 pound bulls on Sunday. We'll have a mountain oyster feed. You're screwed. You can't even, you're banding them. You're just wasting stuff.
I know a lot. You're right. And I have had those and they're good, but, that's just what I do. And I tell you, I'm coming up against a little bit of a hill. There's a lot of people that don't like the banded bulls. They're afraid you miss one or something. And, of course, I'm very diligent. I make sure I get both of them down there and put the band on. But, I've seen some videos about that, and I'm sure you know some of those guys don't like those banded calves.
Well, I don't like banded bulls. You still got to go cut it off if you do it right. But,
true.
I just enjoy the nutrition of a bull fry. That's at the end of the day. All right, we're going to run out of time. Awake Illinois and what we see happening in the school system. Do you think we're making progress at turning this around?
I do think we're making progress. And, you know, some of us at Awake, not me so much, but my other people that live up around Chicago in the Naperville area, they take a lot of criticism. They take a lot of punches. I always say, you know what? We're here and we're going to stand here no matter what for these kids. And you can hit on us all day long. Our lips aren't bloody yet. We can take a lot of punches and keep going. And we're not going away. And I think that we're gaining more and more parents. It's an education thing. You have to make parents aware. We had to make parents aware that the masks were actually harming their children. Now we're dealing with you know, girls and boys, boys and girls bathrooms and stuff like
and
that.
And furries.
All that kind of,
and furries.
Furries and everything. And we know that's wrong. Most people know that's wrong. It's a small minority of people that are being very loud, trying to push that into our lives and into our children. If the parents would just have, you know, some resiliency and some strength to stand up, then that would... got a glitch there. That would solve a lot of problems, but it's hard to do. You know, it's hard to be a one to stand up because you take some blows and you just gotta have big shoulders and be aware of that and do what's right. That's what we say. Do what's right.
Well, that has been the positive side of COVID. I think coming out of that and the mess that we have happening in classroom curriculum and what we're teaching, trying to teach kindergartners, we now have, I'm just estimating, Steve, about tenfold the number of people showing up. You as a school board member, I'd like you to tell me how many times you had a crowd of 20 people in the school board meeting, because I'm guessing it was pretty rare, but today they show up because they want to know and be involved.
It was very, very rare. We didn't have people come in. If there was a tax referendum or something like that, we might have had, over my tenure, 17 years, I'd say maybe twice we had more than 10 people in a school board meeting, right? I mean, it was dramatic. You just didn't have parents come in. And some of that's on the fault of the way the boards are handling it, the way the superintendents try to have total control of a meeting, and sure, people just feel intimidated. But we're changing that. I mean, you see all across the country, Awake Illinois, Moms for Liberty. I just saw there's a group out in Oklahoma, Moms for Liberty, that are doing good things. And these moms are standing up, and dads too. But I've really noticed a big movement of mothers throughout the nation to start with. And we need men. I think men make a difference too when they stand up with those mothers. It's important. We have a war on men as well in this country.
Yep. Next time we have a man march, which we had our last one in September in Mandan, North Dakota, you're going to get an invite, Steve, Lucy.
I would absolutely love to go there.
And in fact, I may bring some of my mountain oysters out of my freezer to my mom's for Christmas, and you'll get an invite to come and enjoy us.
Would love to meet you and do that. That sounds fun.
Steve Lucy joining us from Hancock County, Illinois. Basco, look it up on the map. And tell Gail and Craig I said hi. We have connected the dots. Food producers, food consumers. For Steve Lucy, I'm Trent Luce. Now let's take this last moment. In fact, I'm going to do it as we are talking right here. Go to the website, your favorite search engine. I don't care which one you use. Actually, you don't need to search. Just go to your browser. That's the terminology I'm looking for. CertifiedPiedmontese.com. Just posted it in real Nebraska beef from family ranches to your table. Full page on holiday roast. Check those out. French racked lamb. Hank's going to love that. The tomahawk, the dynasty tomahawk ribeye. Here's a grass-fed tomahawk ribeye, if that's your fancy. Whatever you want, we make it happen. Oh, my goodness. This straight-up tomahawk ribeye steak is incredible. Pork tenderloin. Doesn't look too bad either. That might have a spot breed influence to it. In fact, it does. Get full details about what's going on in the world of marketing beef direct to the consumer from the producer. Thanks to Lone Creek Cattle Company and the ability to network a group of cattlemen in the Great Plains of America to put together a consistent supply of genetics, which is all about the Piedmontese sires. Why Piedmontese? Well, they perform as well as any breed out there. Our performance is absolutely incredible. Our gentle temperament of the calves, I cannot believe how calm they are, because there's been tremendous selection pressure put on that. And then the tenderness aspect. The Piedmontese cattle possess the myostat gene for tenderness. Put all of that together, you got a consistent supply of tender beef the consumer's willing to pay for. You, the producer, need to be rewarded. Full details about that aspect can be found on the web, LoneCreekCattleCo.com. Have a great weekend. See you Monday.